You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Jury's action. Please be seated.
All right, so I'll watch the first one, then I'll hear your argument, Mr. Brennan and Mr. Jackson.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Gilman, if you'd play that first one, please.
They had pulled into the driveway before me, so I was presuming she saw my cracked taillight and was thinking, did you hit my son? I could sense from her that she was looking at me very warily. And then when John's nephew came home, I just wanted to see him and squeeze him. It was quite uncomfortable. I said, Dad, come upstairs to the master bedroom. I said, I think I need to leave. I said, I think John's mother thinks I did something to John.
All right, so tell me why I should admit that clip.
You should admit this clip because it demonstrates consciousness of guilt. On the morning of John's death, Ms. O'Keefe sees her son at the hospital and goes back to Mr. O'Keefe's home. In the driveway is the alleged murder weapon, the Lexus with the broken taillight. It's the middle of a snowstorm, and a prelude to that is a phone call from the defendant's father to the Dighton police looking for a ride to go in and see his daughter at the Good Samaritan Hospital. He's looking for a police ride because the weather conditions are so terrible. When the Dighton Police Department declines that ride, he gets the assistance of his son, and his son and his son's wife pick him up and bring him to the hospital. At the hospital, there are a number of comments made. I think I hit something. There is evidence we have where the defendant, her mother, and her father admittedly discuss in different ways the broken taillight. It is an issue that is primary on their mind. In this tumultuous, grieving moment, the taillight is central between these parties. Uninvited, the defendant and her father go to the O'Keefe house without invitation. They knock on the door and they ask to come in. They go into the house. There does not seem to be any interaction, at least with Peggy O'Keefe. And curiously, they go upstairs for 15 minutes. They stay at the house for less than an hour. This is a family that's grieving the loss of their son. Less than an hour, they go back outside. Instead of leaving in the one car, they take the alleged murder weapon, they get into two cars, and they drive away and remove the Lexus with the broken taillight from the scene. That is clear consciousness of guilt evidence. Removing the murder weapon from an area where witnesses can see, photograph, identify the damage. In fact, despite the other evidence about the cracked taillight in the testimony, it is a centrally contested issue in this case. The defense is already questioned and confronted, as they have a right to do, about the shape, manner, and extent of that broken taillight. The removal of it is helpful for the defendant. And so, the fact that they stay for less than an hour, remove the Lexus from the scene, is important. This statement by the defendant is clearly an attempt to create an excuse, a ruse, for why they removed the murder weapon from the scene. It is an attempt to suggest that she somehow is targeted. She somehow on that morning is victimized. She somehow on that morning is the intent or the object of something that is abusive from Peggy O'Keefe. And so this evidence will demonstrate a key part of our consciousness of guilt evidence on this issue, that there was no viable reason to take that evidence from the scene other than to obscure it. It was not because Peggy O'Keefe yelled at her or intimidated her or threatened her. This was, again, a central conversation between her, her father, and her mother in those early morning hours. This is what was foremost in their mind. And so that's why it's not only relevant, it is an extraordinarily strong piece of the conscience of guilt evidence. And inevitably, the defense may or may not try to provide some type of explanation or excuse, but we have a right to the full force of our proof, and this is part of it.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to the first clip, which is clip four.
That's the only one we're discussing right now.
Then in that case, now that I look at it and I see the transcript, I'll withdraw an objection. I don't care. It's okay. I don't agree with anything Mr. Brennan just said. It doesn't go to consciousness of guilt. As a matter of fact, I think it very clearly shows the opposite.
So there's no objection. So there wasn't an objection until I said, is there any objection to this? And then you all came to sidebar. I mean, they were just going to play. So there's no objection to the first clip, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so let's hear.
I made an objection at sidebar and I'm withdrawing.
Okay, so Mr. Brennan, play the second one, please.
Yes.
And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, I think he looks like he got hit by a car. He looks like he got hit by a car.
Okay, so tell me how this comes in.
Similarly, conscience of guilt evidence, the defendant making what we allege is a false statement to try to excuse her conduct of removing evidence of a crime from the scene. This has additional import. It has two facets to it. One, equally as important for conscience of guilt in the first part, as I supported for clip number four or five. Secondly, it is important because we've heard testimony from Peggy O'Keefe that this claim never happened. So we now have direct testimony that she did not have a conversation with the defendant, did not make these claims to the defendant. And so while also conscience of guilt evidence, it has additional support from the previous clip.
All right, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you. With this video clip, Your Honor, it's very different. It has absolutely nothing to do with consciousness of guilt. The argument is baffling. How could that possibly be consciousness of guilt if my client is simply reiterating something that she believes somebody else said? This clip is obviously, very obviously, and strategically being used to try to vilify my client with something that's completely irrelevant. In Massachusetts, you can't call a witness just for the purposes of impeaching them. What this clip would be doing is purporting to impeach Mrs. O'Keefe, who just testified, I never said that. I never said it. I never leaned over the island counter. Never happened. So bringing this in would be used to impeach their own witness. And that's what can't be done in Massachusetts. With regard to consciousness of guilt, how does my client reiterating or stating that something that the victim's mother may or may not have said, how does that relate to consciousness of guilt? It doesn't. This is simply a wolf in sheep's clothing. They're trying to get it in because it makes my client look bad. They've just put on a very, very sympathetic and empathetic witness, John O'Keefe's mother, and they're trying to make my client, Ms. Reed, look bad by saying something, what they perceive to be pejorative, in a tone that's pejorative about that very same witness. He's trying to, at this point, there is no issue about whether or not Peggy O'Keefe leaned over and said something about the car.
of being hit by the car. He was trying to create the issue so that he could put this video clip in. It has nothing to do with consciousness of guilt.
It's not for impeachment of Peggy O'Keefe. We don't take the position that Peggy O'Keefe is lying. This is a statement of the defendant. It's in the form of an admission or a statement which qualifies for admission substantively, not for impeachment purposes. The defendant should not be able to pick and choose which of her statements do not look good for her and do not look bad for her. She made the statements that are relevant to this case. It's not unfairly prejudicial. It's a statement that they embraced and they chose and they publicized, and it goes directly to the issue of conscience of guilt. Just because it hurts, just because it's incriminating, just because it's difficult for the defense, is not a basis to preclude it. It is an admission, a statement of the defendant. It's admitted substantively.
If that were true, Your Honor, then they would simply put in the transcript. They wouldn't need to play the video. Transcript is one line. And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, I think he looks like he got hit by a car. It looks like he got hit by a car. They could just put that statement in. They want to play this because of its prejudice, because of the tone that it sets. It's not in evidence at this point. The witness who supposedly said the statement has denied having said it and said it never occurred. This is far, far more prejudicial than it is probative. If they want to simply use the transcript, that's one thing. But playing this video is simply being used to vilify my client because of the tone of voice she used in the clip. That's it. That's what's not allowed. That's overly prejudicial, and it's not relevant.
All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to think about this. And if I decide to let it in, you can let it in first thing tomorrow morning. I'm not going to let it in now.
May I ask for a ruling in the morning?
Yes.
May I introduce the one that was not objected to?
Yes. Do you want a consciousness of guilt instruction, Mr. Jackson?
No, we don't believe that it.
So you're in agreement that statement just comes in?
We're not objecting. I'm not trying to introduce it. Don't put words in my mouth. I'm not trying.
No,
to
I said you're,
but,
okay.
But I'm not objecting that it. At this point, then it shouldn't come in.
Okay. We'll bring the jurors back and we'll do that. Tony, can they come right in or is it going to be 5 minutes? Can they come right in? Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
May I clip that's under consideration and just admit the other one?
Yes, and give it to me so I can look at it, please.
This is it.
So, I'm sorry, Your Honor, do you want me to leave that on there so you can look at it tonight? And if we decide to take it off in the morning?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Because you can just single it out and play one, right?
It'll be over in the morning.
Okay, thank you. Chrissy.
All rise for the court, please. Jurors entering. Court is back in session. You may be seated.
Hey,
Yes, please.
Your Honor, I'd like to introduce clip number 4.
They had pulled into the driveway before me, so I was presuming she saw my cracked taillight and was thinking, did you hit my son? I could sense from her that she was looking at me very warily. And then when John's nephew came home, I just wanted to see him. and squeeze him. I don't know, but it was quite uncomfortable. I said, Dad, come upstairs to the master bedroom. I said, I think I need to leave. I said, I think John's mother thinks I did something to John.
May I call my next witness, Your
Please.
Honor?
Please.
The Commonwealth calls Nicholas Garino.
You solemnly swear the evidence you give to the court and jury in the case now and here and should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Thanks. You can do.
Hi. You stand or sit however you're most comfortable, okay?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hey, proceed.
Yes.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury?
Yes. My name is Nicholas Garino.
Mr. Garino, where do you work?
I work the Massachusetts State Police at the Norfolk District Attorney's Office.
How long have you worked for the Massachusetts State Police for?
This is year 10 now.
How long have you been assigned to the District Attorney's Office for?
Since November of 2019, so a little 6 years.
I want to go backwards a little bit. Can you tell me a little bit about what you did before you began working for the Massachusetts State Police?
Yes, sir. I was a NORAD police officer for almost 11 years.
So how long have you been in law enforcement between being a NORAD police officer and a Massachusetts State Police officer?
February of this year, started my 20th year in law enforcement.
Did you go to school before you became a law enforcement officer?
Yes, I went to Westfield State College, Westfield State University now.
Did you graduate?
Yes, I did.
Can you remember what year you graduated in?
Yes, it was 2003.
Did you have a particular degree from Westfield State?
Yes, I double majored. I got a major in criminal justice and mass communications.
When you began as a police officer with the NORAD Police Department, did you have to go into any type of specific training?
Yes, I went to the police academy.
And how long is the police academy?
6 months.
Generally and briefly, what was taught at the academy?
How to conduct investigations, respond to calls. They did a standard field sobriety testing week, physical training, Massachusetts law and criminal procedure.
When you began as a NORAD police officer, were you a patrol officer?
Yes, I was.
And did you remain a patrol officer for the 10 or 11 years you were there?
Yes, I was also part-time in the detail office. But
what does that mean?
Handling jobs when we're off, so filling details like road construction, I'm sorry.
When you left NORAD and began working with the Massachusetts State Police, based on your prior training, did you have to go through further training or were you ready to just begin?
No, I had to go to the State Police Academy for 6 months.
After you got out of the State Police Academy, were you assigned to a barracks?
Yes, I was assigned to the South Boston Barracks for my training. And then once my break-in training was done, I was assigned to the Holden Barracks near Worcester.
At some point during your time in your career with the Massachusetts State Police, did you start to receive any type of training in any specific field?
I'm sorry.
Did you receive any specialized training at the Massachusetts State Police after the academy?
Once I got into the district attorney's office, yes.
And can you tell us a little bit about what type of specialized training you received when you were assigned to the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office?
Yes. So I was hired by the district attorney's office. I do cell phone and computer forensics, as well as I'm a sexual assault investigator. I had prior sexual assault investigator school done, and I went for digital forensics classes as part of my now daily duties.
In order to work with cell phone forensics, did you have any particular background in it at that point?
I had taken some classes when I was at Nord PD, but I didn't have any of the Cellbright or Axiom classes that I do now.
We'll talk about those in a minute so you can give a little more explanation. Did you ever receive a specific advanced degree in data forensics?
No, I didn't.
Did you ever receive any specialized further degree, a master's in data forensics?
No.
So your training came while you were a Massachusetts State Police officer through the Massachusetts State Police?
Yes, that's correct.
What type of courses did you take to learn about forensics?
The first one I took was Cellbright Certified CCO, CCPA is their intro course that teaches you how to use the program and how to extract cell phones using Cellbright program.
There's a couple words I want you to help us understand.
Yes.
The first is an extraction. What is, as simple as you can, a cell phone extraction?
Yes, quite literally is plugging the phone into specialized hardware or software, and it pulls the data from that device to make a digital copy of it so that way we can load it up later to look at it.
So when you extract the phone through a download, it basically mimics the content of the phone, but it's in a different shell, it's in a different form than inside the actual phone itself?
Yes, exactly. That way we're not manipulating or changing any data while looking, because if we were to open the device, it would change data by going through the phone itself or computer.
Okay. When you plug it in, can you explain a little bit about what you're plugging it into?
Yes. So the main program and hardware that we use is GreatKey. It is, again, specialized software and hardware that once the phone's plugged into it, the software is able to extract the information if we have the passcode. If we don't have the passcode and the phone is supported, it's able to guess that passcode depending on how long. Like for an iPhone, if you have a 4-digit, it could take months. If you have a 6-digit, it could take up to 35 years.
So does the phone have to be accessible to actually do that download through GreatKey? Do you have to be able to open the phone with the passcode?
No. So if we don't have the passcode and it's supported, it can guess the passcode without making the phone useless after, say, for an iPhone, it's, I believe it's 10 passcodes.
Is it a quicker process if you do have the passcode?
Much. It would take hours to download the device, depending on how much information's on it.
How do you ensure that the information that you extract from the actual device is accurate and the same when you're making a copy? How do you ensure the integrity of it?
So with GreatKey, it produces a progress report as it goes through its process. There are only two fields that we can sort of amend in that PDF that it spits out is the ID number and then the investigator name. So after the data is pulled out, it creates a hash value, which is like a digital fingerprint for that specific information. So if you had gone in and to edit or change it, that digital fingerprint would change. It would change the big long string of numbers that it attaches to that file.
The digital fingerprint, is that the same thing you're referring to as the hash value?
Yes, exactly.
And how do you ensure that the hash value of the product, the copy, is the same as what's on the phone?
You can run the zip file that it creates with the information into a hash calculator, and it will give the same hash as what is produced from the GreatKey PDF report. So if something had changed or there was an error with it, the hash would not be the same as what was given from the PDF. And that's how we know that the data was not the same.
So if you download a phone and it has a hash value, this digital fingerprint, and then someone was to manipulate the phone and remove anything, even a period, from that data, if it's run again, will the hash value change?
Yes, it would not be the same, because
even
it will shift.
Just, I'm sorry, even if it's just a period?
Yes, any alteration to that initial extraction with that number, it immediately would change.
So if you have an item, a computer or a phone, and you put it through the gray key program, and you do an extraction, a copy, where do you store that copy of information if it's not on the phone that you originally have? What do you do with it?
So once the program pulls that information, we have to place it onto our secure server at the office, and we'll take any of the files that we're given via the extraction process, and it's saved there for us.
And so you copy it on another link or another digital file?
Yes, we'll save it to the server at the district attorney's office.
Can it be put on a physical item, like a zip drive or a hard drive?
Yes.
If you put that download onto a zip drive or hard drive, how will you know if that information on the hard drive matches the same information you originally downloaded from the phone to the server through gray key?
Again, like I said, you could run the hash value of that file again to correlate it with the PDF that we were given once gray key has given us the information. So that's how you would know all the information is the same, nothing has changed.
So for example, if you download an iPhone and it has that digital fingerprint, hash value attached to it, and you make a copy or multiple copies, is the way to test whether or not those copies are exactly accurate is to look at the hash value of each copy?
Yes, and copying the zip file would not change the hash value. The only way it would change is if you physically went into it and deleted information somehow.
So now that you have the item, say for example an iPhone, and you've downloaded it through gray key, which is hardware and software, and it's on a digital file, can you just open it up and start reading it like a report or a book, or do you have to do something else to it?
No. Once it's pulled into that zip file, it has to be opened into another program, which are many forensic tools, but the ones at the office we use are Cellebrite or Axiom. They're two brands, and then those programs make that information readable so we can actually look at it.
So if you were to download a forensic copy and you were to open it up without using that subsequent software, would you be able to read or see anything that's on that data?
To be honest, I don't know because I've never opened one of those zip files to know what's actually in them.
After the extraction happens, after this that copy made, did you mention this further software you would use to be able to actually read the data?
Yes, so that's Cellebrite and Axiom. They're two different programs, but those programs will make the information readable.
Are those the programs that you typically use?
Yes, they are. And there's other programs out there, but those are the two that we normally use at the office.
Are they commonly used in the Massachusetts State Police?
Yes, they are.
Are there other programs beyond Axiom and Cellebrite that can be used to decipher the information so you can read it?
Yes, there's many.
Okay. In your entire time with the Massachusetts State Police, have you used any other programs other than Axiom or Cellebrite?
To look at cell phones?
Yes.
We have Sanderson forensic software that can look at databases that are in the phone to look at information. I don't normally use those because I don't want to say, I'm probably not proficient enough that I would know this exactly means this, or I wouldn't want to confuse anything that I'm looking at.
When you look at the information after it's been through the extraction and then the analysis through the software, is the data still available if you want to look into the data?
From the zip file itself, sir?
Yes.
Yes, that's always available. It's, like I said, the data in the zip file that Gray Key gives us is never changed. It's just being loaded into another program so we can see it.
Do the software that you use, whether it's Cellebrite or Axiom, does that do the work for you as a forensic examiner?
Yes. So it runs, as the program runs, I should say, it will bring up different tabs. So it'll say phone calls, chats, photos, the databases, all different things that Cellebrite their software has run to pull this information out to make it easier for investigators to find what they're looking for.
Beyond the initial report that you can look at and look for the information, if you wanted to as a data forensic examiner, could you look deeper beyond the production of those software programs?
Yes, you could.
Forensic data analysis, when you look at these tools that provide these initial reports, is that the beginning or does it dig deeper when you're a digital forensic analyst?
No, these reports are finding the low-hanging fruit in the proverbial tree. So you're that's showing you the stuff that the program is set that most people are looking for. As I said, the phone calls, the chats. If you need to go deeper into it, as I said, there's other software out there where you can pull these databases and try to go through the code to find what you're looking for. Once you find something, you would have to corroborate it with other evidence or data to make sure what you're looking at is exactly what you're looking for.
Have you been involved in the download extraction and analyzing data on phones as your role with the Massachusetts State Police?
Yes, that's my primary role in the DA's office currently.
And how many years have you been in that role?
Since November of 2019, so 5 years now.
Have you worked on a number of different cases that involve forensic data?
Yes, I have.
Is there a routine or a practice in your present role when you make a copy about what process you use and how you produce it in a case?
I wouldn't say there's a normal process. It's all case dependent. A lot of cases we get, people want PDFs of the information, portable cases that we can create. So it's basically the portable program that I'm using. That way someone could find the information they're looking for, or I give the raw information if requested.
What's the difference between PDF form and raw information?
So Cellbrite can create a PDF form of every bit of information in the phone. It could be like a 10,000 page PDF. It literally just lists everything that's in there. If I create a portable case, as I said, that is basically like me giving you the thumb drive and it's showing you exactly what I'm seeing and you can click on the tabs yourself from your own computer. And then if I give the raw file, that means someone has to go in and load it themselves to look for it.
Typically, when you are producing evidence of discovery in a case, do you produce PDF or the raw file?
As I said, it's all case dependent. Not all cases have forensic experts to come in to look at the information, so I'll supply whatever is requested. Normally, the PDF or the portable case is what I give, but if more is requested, that's readily available.
And so the raw data, if requested, do you provide that as well?
Yes, if requested.
In this case, were you involved in any type of forensic data extraction?
Yes, I did the extractions of multiple phones and analyzed multiple phones in this case.
You mentioned that there's a software and hardware, the Gray Key unit. Where's that located?
That's located in our digital forensics laboratory, which is key card access and alarmed. Excuse me, at the Norfolk DA's office.
Are there other cases or the multiple cases that are occurring at the same time?
Yes, we constantly have phones coming in and out and being worked on.
What if you have a phone and the Gray Key unit's being used? What do you need to do?
We need to wait for that phone to finish, because if we say we unplugged it, it would interrupt that data transfer and we could lose it. So we wait until the phone's done and then the next phone goes up.
Did you become involved in some way in this case?
Downloading devices, sir?
Well, I'm asking generally first.
Yes.
Were you involved in investigating this case as far as speaking to witnesses or going to the scene?
No.
Can you describe the best you can what your role was relative to this case?
Yes, so I was brought, as I said, phones from this case to have the data extracted and then have it ready in our Cellbrite program for the investigators to look at.
At some point, were you provided a phone that you later identified as a phone belonging to Mr. John O'Keefe?
Yes, I was.
Do you remember when you were provided that phone?
Yes, it would be January 29th, 2022, about 7:30 p.m. that night.
Do you remember where you received that phone from?
Yes, I was at the DA's office. I got it from Sergeant Buchanan and Michael Proctor.
Do you remember about what time of night that was?
As I said, about 7 to 7:30 p.m.
Thank you. When you received that phone, did you have the passcode?
No, we didn't.
Without the passcode, what were your next steps?
So the phone was placed in our digital forensics lab until we could get the passcode. I was told that a family member was going to be bringing it in so we could download the device.
Did you ultimately get that passcode?
Yes, we did.
And do you remember when you received it?
January 31st, 2022.
After you received the passcode for Mr. O'Keefe's phone, can you walk us through the process of what you did?
Yep. So once the passcode's obtained, we'll unlock the phone and then plug it into GrayKey, and then it's able to pull the full information from it without having to guess the passcode.
How long does that take?
Again, depending on the size of the phone, a few hours.
After the information was downloaded, then what happened?
We placed on our digital evidence server at the DA's office, and then if the phone is evidence, it would go into evidence. If it was a consent, we'd give it back to the person who gave it to us immediately.
Did this phone go into evidence?
Yes, it did.
When you downloaded the information through GrayKey, which you said was the hardware and software, does it produce a report with that digital imprint?
Yes, it does. It produces a report from the time you plug it in to the process it completes, and then the amount of data, and then, like I said, that digital fingerprint hash value at the end.
And did you do that with this phone, Mr. O'Keefe's phone?
Yes,
may I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
Highlight. I'm going to show you a document, sir.
Okay, sir. Yes, thank you.
I'm sorry.
Did you show it to Mr. Alessi?
I'm sorry. My apologies. Sorry, Mr. Alessi.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
May I?
Yes.
I'm showing you a document. Could you look at both pages, please?
Yes. Okay.
Do you recognize that document?
Yes. This is the...
I'll just ask a couple more questions if you don't mind. What is it?
It's the GrayKey progress report that they give once the phone extractions are completed.
Do you recognize that as the report that is attributed to John O'Keefe's phone?
Yes.
And does that document have that digital imprint, the digital fingerprint that you were talking about?
Yes. So it's in, yeah. So it's here on the back. I just want to see if it was in two places. But it would be here for the, sorry, it's got cut off, but.
Why don't I put it up for an exhibit so that we can I'll ask you some questions.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce this as an exhibit, please.
No objection, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
It's the 18th of March.
May I show that exhibit to the jury?
Yes.
May I approach the witness to show him the pointer?
Yes.
On this top button will be the pointer. The middle button will change the screen. So,
oh, okay.
Stick to the top button, please.
Yep.
Can you walk us through what this report means?
Yep. So here at the top, there it is. Again, it says Gray Key progress report, and then it gives the report generation, date and time, and it is in UTC, which is, get the exact definition, universal time coordinates, I believe. So you'd have to minus 4 or 5 hours, depending on daylight savings time. So this one would have been January's minus 5, 16:10, so it'll be noon, 12 o'clock, for the actual time on the 31st. As we go down, device name is Johnny. The software version is the Apple iOS that was running at the time. The model number, iPhone 11. And then if you were to look up, the N104AP is also a model number. The unique device ID, this one is what GrayKey assigns to the zip file that it creates. Serial number of the phone, the unique chip ID, the Wi-Fi address, the Bluetooth address, and then the phone number. And then there's more information underneath.
Could we scroll that, please? Thank you.
This here is the IMEI, which is the International Mobile Equipment Identifier. It's not uncommon now to have multiple of those identifying numbers. The data partition size of the device, which is 83 gigabytes. The lock state, if the phone was locked, it would say locked. This one is unlocked, so we had the passcode. This was the GrayKey agent version for the software. And then this is the last time that the phone was backed up via iTunes or iCloud. This is the owner's name. You can have anything in this, but his phone had John O'Keefe set as the iPhone owner name. And then the different accounts attributed to the phone.
Okay. Can you show us where the digital fingerprint is?
Yep, it's down. So that the top part here is literally every time when it's plugged in to every process that it completes until the progress report is generated. Here, this is the full file system was created on this date and time. And then even though the partition size was 82 gigabytes, it actually pulled 125 gigabytes of data. Underneath this, if you're on the next page, is that unique fingerprint right here. So it has two, a SHA-256 and an MD5. They're just two versions of hashing to show that the file, the unique fingerprint, and that's what these numbers are here. So there's one for the image of the extraction, and then one for the keychain for the other documents that GrayKey creates.
And you mentioned that if anything has changed, even a period, that number and letter sequence will change as well?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Did you have an opportunity to download and extract any other phones?
Yes.
At some point, did you have an opportunity to download and extract a phone from the defendant?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Do you remember when you received that phone?
I got the phone the same time as I got Mr. O'Keefe's phone, on the 29th and around 7:30 at night.
And so you received both phones at the same time?
Yes.
From the same people?
Correct.
Trooper Buchanick?
Yes.
Trooper Proctor?
Yes.
What did you do with that phone?
Again, that was brought down to the digital forensics lab for holding until we could get into it, or a warrant was written, or whatever legal process was going to be done, so we could get that information.
Do you secure it?
Yes, that room is locked with key card access that only myself and two others have, and it's also alarmed.
Do the case officers or investigators that aren't part of your unit have access to that those items?
No, the only ones that had access were myself, Trooper Connor Keefe, and then the Director Samantha Vogt. She's a civilian that runs our lab.
Okay. At that point, were you able, after there was process, were you able to get into the phone at first?
No, it wasn't supported by GrayKey, the phone model and number.
What do you mean it wasn't supported?
So the software, even if we had plugged it in, GrayKey wouldn't be able to recognize it because it just wasn't supported at that time.
When you say it wasn't supported, does this have anything to do with a passcode?
for both. So we didn't have the passcode, so because we didn't have it, it wasn't supported for us to download that information from the device.
If you had a passcode, would it have been supported?
Yes, it would have been.
So is there a process when you have a phone that you don't have a passcode for to be able to access the content of the phone?
Yes, that's correct. We have to wait until we either have the passcode or the software and hardware is supported for the device where it can try to guess the passcode.
Let me ask you some questions about software. In forensic data analysis, does software change frequently?
Constantly.
When the software changes, does it advance?
Does the software get better?
Yes.
Yes, it does.
At the time you first had the defendant's phone, the software you had was unable to access the contents?
That is correct.
What do you do? Do you look for other software or do you wait for updates? What's the process?
If there is another software out there, we will use it to try to get the information. If not, we are at the mercy of waiting for the developers to come up with the information for us.
Did you wait in this case?
Yes, we did. We had to wait.
Ultimately, did software advance so that without a passcode you were able to access?
Yes.
How long did you have to wait before you were able to access?
I believe it was July of 2022 that the software had been upgraded enough that it was able to brute force or guess her passcode for the device.
And where does the device remain until you're ready to try again?
In that locked digital forensics lab.
So when the software updates and advances, do you know that it will be successful or you plug it in and you try?
No. So on GreatKey, they have like a link where you can click and it brings up a whole matrix. So it shows every make model of phone and then the software associated with it. And it says it can do a partial download, a full download, a password guess. And it tells us. So when there's a new update, we'll check that to make sure that the devices we have can be accessed.
Did you make an attempt to have the software access the phone without a passcode?
Objection, Your Honor. Would we approach, please?
Okay. Thank you. Did you use software inevitably to open the defendant's phone?
Yes.
And how many times did you download?
So there were two downloads, one of the partial part of the phone, and then we, in the same time that we had it plugged in, we had the password brute force guess software installed onto the phone so we would try to guess the passcode. So there were two downloads, one with very limited data, and then one with the full file system extraction, which is everything on the phone that it can get.
May I approach?
Yes.
I'm going to show you two documents, sir.
Dismissal. Let's see.
Did you need a copy?
Thank you, Mr. President.
Do you have an extra copy of the phone? I'm going to show you two documents. The first one, do you recognize that document?
Yes, I do.
Is that a result summary from GreatKey for a search of the defendant's phone?
This is the initial extraction that we created before the password guess process went through.
I'd like to introduce this to the next exhibit, please.
Okay. No objection, Your Honor.
Thank you.
That's the original?
Yes, this is the first one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Exhibit 19.
I showed you a second document. Do you recognize that?
Yes, this is the essentially the same information, except it goes further of all the password guess attempts longer until we actually get all of the information from the phone.
I'd like to introduce this as the next exhibit, please.
All right. No objection, Mr. Lessie?
No objection, Your Honor.
20, Samar.
Could I have the previous exhibit as well, please?
Sir, I'm handing you back Exhibit 19, which was the partial download.
Okay.
Exhibit 20, which was the subsequent download. You mentioned hash value changes with the content of each download?
Yes.
Is there hash values specifically assigned to each download?
Yes, there is.
Are they the same number and digits in digital fingerprint?
No, they're not.
And explain again why they would be different.
Again, the first one was the partial. It was only 45 gigabytes of data, so it has one number. The second download was 109 gigabytes of data once it got the passcode. And again, that number is completely different again. And again, like I said, the information is not the same, so the hash values won't be the same.
Were the two other phones that you inevitably analyzed?
Yes, there were.
Let's start with the first one. Did you have an opportunity to create a file on a phone that came from Kerry Roberts?
Yes, I did.
Now, you said it's a two-step process. First is the extraction, the copying, and then it's creating the file.
That's exactly right.
With Kerry Roberts' phone, did you make the extraction? Did you plug it into the gray key?
No, I didn't.
Who did?
Trooper Connor Keefe.
How do you know Trooper Connor Keefe?
He went to meet with Kerry Roberts, received the device from her. He brought it back to the office and did the extraction. His name is also on the extraction gray key progress reports as well. And he wrote two state police reports regarding it.
Do you work with Connor Keefe?
Yes.
Yeah,
I would say we do the same, essentially the same job working together.
So he's in your unit?
Yes, he is.
In the digital forensic unit?
That's correct.
That phone, did it come with any paperwork, any forms?
Yes, he had two signed waivers of consent from both parties for each device, one for each device.
And so as far as the copying, the extraction, you did not do the extraction on Kerry Roberts' phone?
No, I did not.
After it was plugged in and a copy was made, did you then access it?
Months down the road.
Were you assigned at that point to analyze or look at any of the data on that phone?
Initially, no.
At some point, did you create a file so that you could provide it to the parties?
Yes, I did.
Was that upon request?
Yes, it was.
And separately, did you know or did you, let me ask it a different way, was a phone from Jennifer McCabe extracted?
Yes, it was.
Did you do the extraction?
No, I did not.
Was the information after extracted again provided to a digital file?
It would have been, yes.
Did you, at some point later, did you make a copy to provide to the parties?
Yes, I did.
Can you tell us what a USEF reader is?
So the UFED reader is a portable case that I can create through Cellbrite. Again, like I said, it's the exact same program that I would be viewing if I was sitting at my desktop. Instead, it can be made into a thumb drive to give to defense, prosecution, investigators, whoever. And there's no chance for the data to be manipulated because it's just a reader.
When you have the digital file that's been extracted and then created into a PDF or a form that can be read, can you print the entire file on paper if you'd like?
Yes, you could.
Could you print it so it includes the entire content of the phone?
Yes, it'd be thousands of pages, but yes, you could.
Is there any way to isolate particular things of interest that you might want? For example, if you wanted just the chats between two people, is there a way that you could have a program isolate just those chats and then give you all of them in a form that you could read?
Yes, so you can go in to cherry pick whatever information you're looking for to create into PDFs or other, it gives five, I think, different mediums. You can have an output, HTML, portable cases, XML files.
If you wanted to create a document that had a number of people in communications, could you do that as well?
Yes, you could.
So you can pretty much set the parameters how you want if you want to search for particular items.
Yes, it's very generous, that way of being able to search for keywords, phone numbers, whatever it is, and then you can export that out into a PDF so you can print it.
May I have a moment, Your Honor?
Yes.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.